Welcome to episode 20 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, political science professor at University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Today I'm talking to Ryan Carlin, who is associate professor of political science at Georgia State University, and he studies comparative political behavior, especially in Latin America. So Ryan, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you, Greg, for the invitation.
Before I even get to the substantive questions, I was starting to do a quick question at the beginning just for everybody, just to ask you, how did you get interested in Latin American politics initially?
I got interested in Latin American politics through study abroad in Chile in 1998. It didn't strike me when I was there, but only afterwards how strange it was that half of the people who had host families had portraits of Pinochet, and half the family who had half the other host families had portraits of Allende. And so I got puzzling on that, even probably after graduation, and then I just couldn't stop thinking about it. So I was teaching Spanish at the time at a high school in Montgomery, Alabama, and took some kids to Chile on a summer trip, and we went up to the north and saw one of the mass graves in the desert. And at that point, the students asked a million questions, and just answering those questions got me so excited. And I just realized I should probably go back and figure out a way to talk about Latin American politics as a lifestyle, not just a one-time thing.
Oh, that's awesome. I was there in 98 as well. I was doing my doctoral work in 97 and 98.
I'll be darned.
Living with a family who did not have a portrait of Pinochet on the wall. Okay, so you've done a lot of work on accountability. Tell me, when are Latin American voters likely to punish presidents for the economy, which is sort of a timely topic now?
Yes, it is. In my responses, I'll probably refer to we instead of I, because I've been working with several people on questions related to this, including Cecilia Martinez-Gallardo, Greg Love, Matt Singer, Tim Helwig, Jonathan Hartland, and Shane Singh. So I can't take full credit for any of the answers I might have. This is really a collaborative effort, and I've learned so much working with these guys. So,
and then you also won't take all the blame then.
I won't take all the blame. I've learned to shift blame.
Exactly.
So by accountability, we sort of mean whether you punish or reward leaders for past behavior most of the time. So it's kind of like sanctioning. And so we see accountability in a couple of flavors. First of all, we have elections, which are huge instances in which the citizens get to cast their vote and throw the bums out if they like, or keep them for longer. And so we have a fair amount of evidence that this basic mechanism of economic voting works in Latin America. But between elections, we have accountability happening in a couple of interesting behavioral ways. The first and most provocative are these public reactions that get people into the streets. And so we saw this, of course, during the neoliberal era, where we had these seismic shifts in the economic structure, and that brought people into the streets. Their perceived well-being going forward and their immediate well-being were totally changed. And so this was costly for a lot of presidents in Latin America, and we saw presidents not finishing their terms throughout the region. Not everywhere, but in many cases. So there's this sense that when you introduce some kind of uncertainty, that can actually trigger a lot of economic accountability. And then the other form of accountability between elections is more quotidian, but I think it's really important, and it takes place in the court of public opinion. And so you kind of see this on two levels. Within the individual, you can kind of say, oh, on a given day, Latin Americans can and do ground their approval of the president in how they think of the economy. And so they can think of the economy in terms of their own, how well they're doing compared to last year, or how well the country's doing, or how well do they expect themselves and the country to do going forward. And we see pretty good evidence that this actually happens at the individual level. Then at a more macro level, we see big macroeconomic indicators like inflation, growth, unemployment, they all kind of have the expected effects on presidential approval. And we're gathering data on consumer confidence to test that link as well. And so far it pretty much works. Then the question is, well, what explains the extent to which you have economic accountability? And there we have a couple of suggestive findings, and that's really your main question, but I thought I'd lay out the structure a bit before.
And so
a recent paper I've got working with Tim Helwig is looking at a question that became very important after this move toward neoliberalism in Latin America, which was, you know, how does the economic structure affect accountability? And what we basically found is that the more open you make the economy, the less accountability you actually have. This was a question that Sue Stokes took up a long time ago in tandem with the question of how representative are these governments. And the literature really went more down the line of how representative is this, and they kind of left the accountability question alone. And so we were able to compile data over the last three decades and show that the more closed your economy is, the better accountability you have. We think there's a bit of we think what's going on is that, you know, there's some responsibility. When you say the state is going to intervene in various ways, we're going to not let the markets work, we're going to try to fix them in some ways, then whatever happens is now yours.
Right.
You begin to own the economy much more. And so, yeah, you get higher economic accountability. It probably means that statist presidents are you know, more likely to suffer, you know, under a downturn. On the other hand, it sort of lets the neoliberal presidents off the hook, right? Because they can always say, well, you know, the market will do what the market will do. I can't really be held accountable for this. And so it does create some interesting asymmetries across the country, across the countries in the region.
So my next question was related to the forecast for slow growth, economic growth in 2010 in Latin America. And so would we logically expect more unrest in some countries? Does that answer of statism versus neoliberalism start answering that about where we would expect it?
I think it does. I mean, this is all, you know, I've tried to explain the past, not predict the future. But if we do have any predictive power, you know, we might see governments of the left where they, if they preside over the economy going down, we should see more unrest. And we've already seen some unrest. It's not like the slowdown started happening a while ago with the end of the commodity boom, and big countries that have closed economies like Brazil, like Venezuela, you're seeing them. You've seen obviously huge protests and very important implications for Dilma Rousseff and Nicolas Maduro there, and so I think that kind of fits the narrative that we're trying to spin.
Okay. Now, switching gears a little bit to some other work that you've done about democracy. In general, when are Latin Americans happiest about democracy?
There is no there's no easy answer here. I think everything depends on the way both the citizens define democracy and how scholars want to measure it. And you know, if you measure it in if you say, well, democracy is too impossible, we can't talk about it. We can only measure things that are principles of democracy. We can't mention the word democracy, but we can only talk about things like system support, as Mitch Seligson does. Then we have some pretty consistent findings about when Latin Americans approve democracy, and they're not going to surprise anybody. A strong economy, when they think they're doing well, they like democracy, and I think rule of law has a lot to do with this as well. So when there's perception that people are insecure, or when there's a perception that elites are corrupt and taking advantage of their position. Those things really hurt people's evaluations of this system called democracy. And at the same time, if they've been victims of crime or actual victims of corruption, we see even larger effects. So the rule of law is really important for the way people value democracy. They want to know that the system that they put in place is somehow better than the ones that they have otherwise lived with, less democratic systems where the rule of law isn't so prevalent.
Well, and so let me. This kind of brings up for me a methodological question, because you've done a lot of work with the Latin American Public Opinion Project, and so they ask about democracy. How, if we're asking people in Latin American countries about democracy, how much stock can we put in the answers, given that the interviewer doesn't tell them what the definition is, and all respondents might have different definitions?
That's a great question, and it's actually the question that drove my dissertation. And I finally will have a paper come out on this very topic 10 years after the fact in political psychology next year. And my question is, so what if it's very clear that people can say they support democracy, but then when you ask them about the things that we think are associated with liberal democracy, they hold all kinds of opinions. And so what I've tried to do both in that paper and in other papers, with work with Matt Singer, work with Mason Mosley that I've wound up getting published and work on my own, is try to say we can take democracy, we can take people's attitudes as democracy as meaning something, but not everything. We have to consider support for democracy as a cluster of attitudes. And in some cases, that support for democracy is going to be paired with all the same support for the civil liberties and the political rights that we would all associate with it when we define liberal democracy. I've pretty much found that everywhere I've looked for it. On the other hand, there are these people that say they support democracy and then would allow all kinds of deviations from that liberal democracy baseline definition. And so I think that people's reaction to democracy tells you something, but certainly not everything. I'm always curious of the people that say they don't support democracy. On the other hand, so if they answer no, I don't think democracy is the best form of government, and they're living in a democracy, I sort of ask, okay, well, what do you feel about the other civil liberties and political rights you enjoy? And it turns out there aren't too many people who are pure authoritarians in that sense. Not that many people are excited about giving up, First Amendment rights, and they're actually sometimes tolerant of the opposition. So I would say we can't take it at face value, and we should always consider the other values and beliefs that people hold about democracy.
Okay. And my next question is actually interesting given the level of polarization in the United States, but you've done work on trust gaps. So tell me a little bit about that and how that's relevant for Latin America.
Trust gaps. We have taken a behavioral economic measure of trust based on a game called the trust game. It's a pretty simple game. Imagine two players that don't interact. They don't know anything about each other. Let's say they play a game where player one is given, let's say, $10, and so is player two. Player one is told you can share any amount with player two. Let's say you share $7 with player two. Then they're told whatever amount that they share will be tripled. So if they share $7, they keep three, $7 becomes 21, and then player two receives that $21 in addition to their own 10 that they started out with. So now player two has $31, player one has three. But player one is also told that player two will have the opportunity to share some of that amount back with player one. So player one thinks to himself, can I be better off by trusting? And do I expect this person to reciprocate? Obviously, both player one and player two can be better off if they work together. So it's a public goods game in some ways. It's not exactly that, but there is a public good created by this tripling aspect, and it gets to the idea that we can all be better off if we trust and reciprocate. And so, based on that simple game, we have looked at whether or not people's trust behavior varies depending upon the partisanship of the person they are playing with. The first paper we wrote on this was on the U.S., and we recently have a forthcoming paper that looks at about 8 or 9 different countries in which partisanship really matters a lot. And what we find consistently, and not surprisingly, is that people trust their co-partisans more than the people who are their rival partisans. That is not – we shouldn't be too worked up about that. We should expect that based on lots of theory and psychology about in-group, out-group discrimination and bias. So we expected that, but what we find is that the perception of people's perception of polarization among the parties really drives the extent to which they distrust the other party. What's interesting is that reciprocity has no bearing. There is no effect of partisanship on reciprocity. In other words, people reciprocate to the extent that they are trusted, regardless of whether they're playing with a co-partisan or a rival partisan. So it presents this sad scenario in which reciprocity would exist if only trust would exist, but polarization is making it difficult for people to trust across party lines. And so we think in the U.S., this is something that goes on. I mean, I remember someone moved into my neighborhood and put up a yard sign for a governor of the opposite party that I support, and we decided not to take them over a welcoming gift. There's this interpersonal thing that goes on, what I worry about in Latin America is the polarization reaching the social level. So if we have partisan polarization, that does a lot of good things for parties and for competition and allows voters to distinguish one party from the other. But when it gets too hyper-polarized, it could filter down into social relations and really hurt their ability to work together. It hurts their ability to compromise and to support leaders who compromise. So that's my main worry for Latin America. Just looking at the region, the places where you would expect it would be where parties are really strong and they have a social connotation. I think your biggest candidates were Chile and Uruguay. And when we looked, and now Chile is sort of undergoing a massive change in what partisanship means there, and the party system is really in flux there. And so I'm not sure that it's a problem going forward in Chile. Uruguay has really changed insofar as it's now the Frente Amplio, the Frente Amplistas against the traditional parties of the Colorado and Blanco. So you hope that it doesn't reach a fevered pitch in Uruguay. The rest of the region, I think we'd love to do this in Venezuela and in Bolivia, where we think these parties have a strong social identification to them as well. And we expect that perceptions of polarization will have extremely huge effects there and are having huge effects. I mean, you can imagine the support of the Chavistas and the non-Chavistas, there's a huge chasm that is dividing them, and you can see it on all press reports of what's going on in Venezuela and their ability to reach any kind of compromise. So I think this holds some promise for understanding the social implications of partisanship, which goes hand in hand with democratization, and it's usually championed, but it can have problems when it becomes polarized.
Okay, and so that leads really naturally into my last question, which is that, and I know that we in academia and political science were always leery about predicting, but based on all this and the questions about the relationships of the parties to trust or distrust, slow economic growth, et cetera, looking forward, not just this year, but kind of in the near term, should we be optimistic or pessimistic about support for democracy in Latin America?
Well, I believe this confluence of factors will probably result in larger winners-losers gaps. What I mean by that is people who vote for the winners will be exceedingly happy with democracy, and the losers will be increasingly less happy with democracy. My friend Matt Singer has got a book project working on this, and he's finding really strong effects for this. In terms of democracy, I think it will become the only game in town. The question is, what about these other democratic principles and norms? Are we going to see the public support strong presidents curbing the press? Are we going to see them support locking up dissidents and so forth? That's sort of my worry. I don't feel like there's not going to be an easily articulated alternative to democracy coming up. But what we will see, I think, are these deviations from what we consider liberal democracy continue. And the question is, which parts of that definition, which elements of liberal democracy will be peeled back first and where? So I'm not pessimistic, but if we're going to see something, if we're going to see a downturn, if we're going to see it go downhill, that's what it's going to look like. That's my gut reaction to the question.
Yeah, and I mean, we have seen attacks on the press in a number of countries increase over the past several years.
Certainly. So that's, again, that supporting democracy is not enough. There has to be something. The norms of democracy have to be fully inculcated.
All right, we are out of time. Ryan Carlin is Associate Professor of Political Science at Georgia State University. Ryan, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Greg. It was a pleasure.